Welcome to the midweek Mission Ridge podcast known as Footnotes. Footnotes is here to give you some of the stuff that we didn't have time to cover in the sermon and encourage you to dig in deeper as you study the text. So let's dive in and check out what's in the footnotes. Welcome to another episode of Footnotes, your favorite midweek Mission Ridge podcast. Today we've got Rob Croyle and myself, Logan Daly. Say hi, Rob.
Say hi, Rob. Hi, Rob. I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
You were processing. I caught you off guard. Yeah. It's fine. We were discussing this week. Rob is an internal processor, and so occasionally I'll just be rambling, and he's over there looking at his laptop, looking something up, processing something. And so he has to go back and actually listen to the Footnotes podcast to find out what I said. So that's a fun fact. There's our trivia for the day.
It is true. I am an internal processor, and sometimes I'm embarrassed by that fact because someone will ask me a question. I'll start processing, and then if I had like a dual thread processor, it worked better. Ooh. I don't have a single thread processor. Mm. And sometimes what I'm processing is, oh my Lord, I'm processing and everybody's watching.
That's unfortunate.
Yes.
See, some of us have a built-in buffer wheel, like me. The buffer wheel is there are words coming out of my mouth. I'm buffering. I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm buffering and thinking about what you just got me to think about. There you go. Maybe that's the quick and dirty discipleship moment of the day right there, is understand how people process so you can better disciple them. Better communication. It's key. All right. Well, we wanted to keep this one under like 6 hours, so let's dig right in with I'm going to call it a shortcoming, but it's not a shortcoming. It's just a fun little thing. You mentioned Abraham because we're talking covenants, and you mentioned during the sermon, you asked who was under the Abrahamic covenant, if you had descendants of Abraham, and there was a couple of people that raised their hands for this.
Yes, sheepishly.
Sheepishly, like, yes, or like, yes, but I'm ashamed. Which one was it?
Like, First one.
I'm not sure if I am. Yes, maybe. What's the right answer?
Yes, maybe.
I'm in Sunday school, and the answer is Jesus.
Well, because I asked, raise your hand if you're a people.
Sure, everybody raised their hand.
Everybody
literally
raised their
everybody
hand.
In the room. That was good.
I was glad.
We had nobody was asleep. People. So yeah, a lot of people.
That was great. And then I said, raise your hand if you're a descendant of Abraham. And there were three ladies that raised their hand that I noticed.
Sure.
And it caught me off guard because I was really expecting...
Like zero.
Zero.
Yeah, you were visibly caught off guard. It was kind of funny. Not going to lie. I giggled in the back. I giggled a little bit.
I'm like, oh, well, you're a descendant of Abraham. Good job.
Well, I think that's literally what you said. It was awkward. It was great. We love you, Rob. But as I thought about this a little bit more, it makes sense that we would have a little bit of confusion because there is this well-known ditty, at least well-known to me and well-known to many, that we would sing as children.
A ditty.
A ditty,
yeah.
Not the P. Diddy, but A. Diddy. Although I think he went by Diddy at one point. This might be a ditty with T's. Somebody look that up and let me know. But the song Father Abraham, which I remember singing in the Methodist Church in Wendell, Idaho. It was before we switched to the Hagerman Methodist Church. Wendell, Idaho, and we would sing that, and we would march around. We marched in a circle while we sang this song. Father Abraham had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. I am one of them, and so are you. So let's all praise the Lord. Right arm, left arm, right leg, left leg. Right, I don't know, turn around.
Yeah.
It was a whole thing. I cannot believe I remembered that much of that.
Yeah,
I started singing that, and I was thinking like, oh man, I'm going to forget the lyrics halfway through. This is going to be embarrassing. I'm going to have to edit myself out.
Well, you might want to edit me out.
Oh, this it's fine.
This is dual track, right?
We're gonna crank that right on up. But that song, like, I am one of them and so are you.
So they were not wrong.
Like, they just jump to the end of the story. Is that a heritable song?
They jump to the end of the story. Yeah.
Spoiler warning.
Which, you know, so they were, you know, the answer is yes. We are all children of faith. Therefore, we are children of Abraham.
We're grafted into the tree.
We're grafted in. And so they were answering the question as they have probably from a historical.
Sure.
You know, or from what they've been taught. They were not wrong. I meant physically.
Physically a descendant.
A part of the genealogy. That's what I was after. They didn't know that, which is fine. But yeah, it's great to know that you're a child of Abraham and to identify that way.
Sure.
But we were trying to bring some context to the conversation.
Which, as I think of this now, this is, and I don't have an answer for this. I think I need to chew on this one some more. But perhaps if you're listening to this, you have an answer, or you can chew on this with me, of if we're under, like, if we're all children of Abraham at some point, this, you know, at this point, that we're all children of faith, children of Abraham.
As Paul presents in Romans.
Sure. Are we under the Abrahamic covenant? I have no idea. That just popped into my head.
Well, I think that's what our friend Marty would say. We borrowed his diagram.
Mm-hmm.
We borrowed the diagram that he's been using to communicate this, and he puts the God-fearing Gentiles, the theosebases, under the umbrella of Abraham. And I think he would say that it's a circumcision of the heart, as Paul expresses.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Versus a physical circumcision, which some of us today are circumcised as Gentiles just because that's a medical thing that people choose.
It's really common in America.
Yeah, it's not so much a religious expression, but more of a health, there's potentially health benefits there, I'm not sure.
That's a whole messy you do not want to go there. That is a whole messy topic.
So, walking away from that dumpster fire and pressing on.
Just hard left turn and avoiding that conversation for now. Now you can go research that if you want, but...
it's interesting that the Jews of today will tell you that taking on circumcision has more to do with the Sinai covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's... How do you know if someone's taking on the Sinai covenant? It's through circumcision.
Sure.
Even though all of Abraham's descendants... And so,
graft didn't even include... That would have been Ishmael, too.
Right. So, I'm not sure what that means, necessarily. Yeah. But that's an interesting conversation.
Definitely some more to flesh out, pun intended. There you go. You're welcome.
There you go.
All right. Next topic. Name change. / order change.
Yeah.
Now, we've been talking about Paul and Paul going on journeys, and we're talking more about this week. I'm talking about that in the sermon and covering his journeys. But this week we see Paul, you talked about Paul going back to Jerusalem for this Jerusalem council. He's part of this. Of course, he's not called Paul at this point. He is being called Paul at this point.
Yeah.
Yes.
His name Jerusalem changes.
Council is in chapter 15. His name changes in 13.
That's correct.
That's right. All right.
So if you listen closely to the sermon, you'll see that I reference Barnabas and Saul, I think, 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And then I reference Paul and Barnabas when Paul's name changes.
Boom. Flip.
3 times.
Oh, well done. How shrewd of you.
A little chiastic.
You planned that out, you sneaky devil.
A little chiastic.
Look at you go. So what we see in the book here is that as you're reading through Acts, you've got the before the name change, it's always Barnabas and then Saul in the order.
Correct.
Barnabas, Saul, Barnabas, Saul, Barnabas, Saul. And then after the name change, it flips to Paul, Barnabas, Paul, Barnabas, Paul, Barnabas.
And there was one time in 15 that Barnabas is listed first. But the rest of the time in Acts, when we see them moving in particular, heading some direction.
Sure.
It's listed Paul and Barnabas. So it's...
In 15, do you remember off the top of your head where it's listed Barnabas and then?
I think it's when they're told that they're going to take the letter. I think it's when James is speaking.
Let me look that up real fast. I'll bet that actually has some significance.
Yeah, and so when we look at Scripture and we see a name change, God is always trying to communicate something about that name change. We see Abram's name changed to Abraham, and at the same time, Sarai, her name is changed to Sarah. We see Jacob's name changed to Israel. And there's something that God is communicating through that name change. And so we were talking last week when we were prepping for this that, you know, well, we were wondering what did their names mean. We knew that Saul is a kingly name. Both Sauls of the Bible, of the Old Testament and the New Testament, come from the tribe of Benjamin. So there's that ancestral connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Saul means prayed for, or one. You know, it's like an answer to prayer. Like, I was praying, and God answered, and you are that answer.
You were prayed for. We called for you,
yeah. Okay. So
you got this kingly name previously, and then he switches it to Paul, which is, where does Paul come from?
Well, it's Greek.
Okay.
And it means small.
So it's a Gentile name that means small.
Humble.
Humble and small, Gentile. So you've got this Pharisee.
Highly trained.
A highly trained priest of the faith. Paul would have been that. He was trained in this. Trained by Gamaliel, etc. And he's got this kingly name, Saul, right? High and mighty, very Jewish name.
Yeah.
And then he decides to change it to a lowly, humble Greek name, a name of the Gentiles. I would say this definitely speaks into his mission of he is feeling that he is sent to the Gentiles. Very much so. He's identifying with them. He's going after them. Also, this one's a little bit further out there, but the name of the first man that he converts in, I think that's in 13.
That is in 13.
They were on Cyprus, I believe.
Yes.
And the Barnabas and Paul in Cyprus. Where's the name? Whole island as far as Paphos. They came upon a certain magician. They run into Bar Jesus. He was with the proconsul, Sergius Paulus. So, and this is the first convert that we hear about.
Right.
This is Paul's first convert. And we're going to learn about this more this week, so I don't want to give away too much there, but first convert, and then his name changes to Paul.
To small.
Small.
Takes on a small name.
A humble little Gentile name. So there's a tasty little footnote for you. You can chew on that one. Side note, I did look it up, and it says Paul Barnabas a couple of times during the Jerusalem Council there in 15. And then when they're hearing them speak right after Peter, after they had heard Barnabas and Paul tell of all they did, that's where it flips it.
Right.
And the other thing that we need to add here is when they change the order of the names, the significance of that, which is that when they're listing names in, when you're reading names in the Bible, they're listed in order of importance a lot of times. there's significance. I should say there's significance in the order that names fall in.
Yeah, and not always, not every time, but when you look at the majority, like when you see Barnabas and Saul, like over and over and over again, and then all of a sudden the name changes and that order flips, Luke is hinting at something there, and you have to step back and look at it and go, well, what do you mean by that? And probably what he means is at one point, Saul was being ministered to, discipled by, led by Barnabas. Mm-hmm.
Barnabas is the authority, the senior, the leader of their twosome.
Yeah. But out of design differences, maybe giftedness, or even just passion.
Sure. At some point it flips.
And as Paul is going places, Barnabas is joining him in that. And Paul is taking lead for some reason.
Sure. Sure.
And so, you know, it's an interesting transition. And it's worth noting.
Definitely. Definitely. There's a lot of possible implications of that.
Yeah.
So, continuing on, the Noahic Covenant. We talked about this on Sunday. This was the one up at the very top of the screen, the big overarching. This is all the peoples.
All the peoples.
Everything under the sun, all of the plants, animals, creatures, peoples on the earth are under the Noahic Covenant.
Right, right. So, in Genesis 9 is where we find the covenant being established by God. And it says, starting in verse 1, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens and upon everything that creeps on the ground and of all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I give you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for you, life blood, I require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning from the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. And then God talks about his part, starting in 8. And then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. It is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off from the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. Hmm. So, what I said in the sermon is that the rabbis will tell you that the Noahic Covenant, that there's three criteria that man has to take part in order to be part of this covenant. Like, we have a choice to either participate in this covenant or to not participate in this covenant. Doesn't matter what our parents did, our grandparents did. You know, sure. We could be fifth generation, whatever, and it's still, this is an individual decision, an individual choice. And they'll tell you that out of this, the three requirements are this, that you abstain from sexual immorality.
Okay.
That you value life.
The sanctity of life.
Sanctity of life.
Okay.
And then the third is to worship God alone. No idols.
Yep.
And this seems to mesh with what the disciples, they've interpreted this way as well, because they mention the no idols. They mention the no fornication or sexual immorality, and then they identify, you know, blood.
No, strangled meat and blood.
And no blood.
They split that into two specifically, but it's both of those are under the sanctity of life.
Right.
Sure.
Ultimately, what I see here is God resetting the table with mankind,
mm-hmm.
and saying, listen, folks, I designed this world to work a certain way. Be fruitful and multiply. Like, yes, that I've designed sexual intimacy within a certain construct. Mm. Be fruitful and multiply. I value life. Revere life. Don't be, you know, revere the fact that I've given living creatures the ability to move and so if you're going to have a steak, you know, pour off the blood. Hmm. You know, if you're going to kill an animal in order to feed your family, that's fine, but you know, pour off the blood and how you treat that animal in the process of taking its life matters.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a video a couple of weeks ago about this national dairy farm that was just, they were doing things to the cows that was just, it was,
sure.
It was lunacy the way they're, you know, kicking them. And it was just hard to watch. Like, why would you treat anything like that breeze lives and breeze? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Somehow they just didn't value the fact that these creatures were made by God and that he gave them the ability to, you know, provide for us in significant ways. So,
Well, and in the Genesis thing, when I hear you reading it, it does make a deal out of the blood, which, and correct me if I'm wrong here, or if you can, the Jewish thought was that the life force dwelt in the blood.
Yes.
Blood carried the life force, like your, I don't know what else to call it, your essence was carried in your blood.
Yeah.
Is that a fair characterization?
I think that is a fair characterization, yes.
And so that
I think
makes
it even
sense.
Says that in here.
Like, that makes sense that you would value how you handle that, how you treat that. Even within the sacrificial system, we see that. Like, blood plays an important part. This is where on the back of the scapegoat, they would smear the blood of the other one, right? I don't think I'm screwing that up, but this is like the blood plays an important part in the sacrifices.
It does. And I don't remember how the scapegoat piece works.
I'm pretty sure it's the one that they sacrificed. They put the blood of that one on the back of the scapegoat and then send that off into the wilderness.
Yeah. And there's this within the Jewish culture, there's this strong ethic of using only what we need to use.
Mm.
Like revere God and the creation he made, like be a good steward of what you have and be a good steward of the land, be a good steward of the animals, be a good steward of your own body. Like I feel like there's a strong ethic of they have maybe a better connection than the average person to God as creator and God as designer, and letting that creation and that design, that original intent,
function as it is supposed to,
kind of define the way we choose to live with each other.
Mm.
And so I don't take your life because I know who your creator is.
And I value the fact that God created you.
I value, look at David and Saul, like David refused to take the Lord's anointed, you know, lay a hand on him because God anointed him. And so it wasn't so much that he revered Saul, he revered the one who did the anointing.
Sure.
And respected that. And so this is where this ethic comes from. It's you know, it doesn't mean, you know, when I was talking Sunday and saying, well, you know, this we fall under the Noahic covenant, so here's these three ethics that the early disciples are saying that the Gentiles need to
abide by.
Does that mean, well, that's the only thing that we look at? No, Jesus says an awful lot about how to live life and what being part of the kingdom looks like. And so all the things that Jesus says, I think, applies.
Sure, but I'd make the case that those three are very broad.
They are.
And so having sanctity for life, for example, that has broad overarching implications in my life. If I'm saying I'm going to value what God has created, that's going to change how I treat people. If right. I'm, because it's not just like I'm killing them. Like, this changes how I treat them. This changes how I treat the animal. This changes how I walk out my day to day. So I think you could probably at least make a case. I don't know how strong of a case, but I think you can make a case that all of Jesus' teachings fit under those also.
Yeah, Jesus thoroughly was connected with the thought that God is creator and I'm a steward.
Sure.
You know, he says he wouldn't even say anything that was contrary to what the Father said.
Yeah.
You know, let alone live his life in a way that is contrary to the design of creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those three broad rules kind of cover most everything. And it almost becomes, when you start to think about it, it becomes difficult to keep all of those. Like, compared to, if you have 613 laws that are very black and white, like do this, don't do this, do this, don't do that.
Right.
Versus three very broad guidelines.
Yes.
That now you have to wrestle with every one of your actions and say, where does this fall?
Which is why I said on Sunday that, you know, we all pick an ethic. Mm. And yet we fail the ethic that we choose. Like you and I could look at valuing life as happening in very different ways. I could choose to not hunt and to not eat animals, mm-hmm. you know, and you could choose to, you know, only hunt for what you need and
sure.
and no more than you need. And so maybe for you, living out the ethic of valuing life means you're not going to go after a trophy kill. You're mm-hmm. only going to go after, you know, a kill that would actually sustain you and your family. So thing, you know, putting meat in your freezer, you know, kind of thing.
Sure.
And so we could live out the same kind of ethic, both revering God through the living out the ethic, but look different, you know, in its application.
Sure. Very much so.
And yet recognize that I don't always live my ethic perfectly, and you don't always live out your ethic perfectly. And oh, by the way, all that really means is we really need Jesus.
Yeah, you really need that. Like, that's why, that exemplifies why we need the grace.
Yeah.
Because despite the fact that I have some ability to figure out what that ethic looks like, and in some senses I get to choose my own ethic. Bear with me here. Choose my own ethic in some ways.
Right.
Broadest. I'm meaning this in the broadest sense.
Right.
That I get to choose my own ethic. Even though I do that, I still fail my own ethic that I've chosen in the broadest of senses.
Yep.
I'm still failing at it. Like, I still need grace.
And I think we are accountable to God for the ethic that we choose.
Sure.
Now, sometimes in my life, I have either ignored God's ethic or chose or defined an ethic in a certain sense because it seemed more attainable to me,
mm.
or more desirable. And you know, and I'm thinking especially early years, my relationship with the Lord, where I knew that sexual promiscuity was a concern, that that was, like, I knew I was sinning against my own conscience in that. But I didn't have the maturity to know how to do things differently, one, and I didn't have the discipleship that that told me how to get from here to there, because I didn't know how to have relationships differently. And I don't say that as an excuse. I'm just saying that going with the current of the flow of culture seemed easier. By choosing a lesser ethic, I was also choosing not to experience God in the midst of that. Because I think what I found is that that when I actually choose God's ethic, even though I'm, a lot of times in choosing God's ethic, I'm going, Lord, I don't know how to do this differently. I don't know how to do these relationships differently. I don't know how to be fulfilled in what you've designed, or being fulfilled and being in just obeying you and trusting that you have good things for me, and going against the grain of culture, I guess, especially. But as I chose to do that, as I chose to go against the grain of culture, to choose the higher standard, to recognize that God was calling me to something more and something better, that I actually got to experience God in that. And in particular, at one point, I was living with my girlfriend at the time, who would become my first wife, and I had someone in Bible study say, Rob, I'm confused. I don't know what you're doing here. And I'm like, yeah, me either. And so I went to my pastor. He was my mentor. And I said, how do I fix this? I don't know what to do. And so he talked me through it, and he journeyed with me, and he showed me grace in the midst of it. And I stopped sinning against my own conscience. I knew what the ethic was. No one had to tell me, but when they did it in a loving way to say, how do we help you get back on path where we think you want to be anyway? And I experienced so much peace through that. And they helped me get married. They helped me honor God with my relationship with her. So sometimes we choose those ethics, a lower standard or a lesser ethic, just because we either don't have the discipleship to do different, or we don't want to go against culture. We don't want to, you know, go against the grain, as it were. But it really is for our best. And we are accountable for whatever ethic that we choose. We are actually accountable to God. And we may miss out on experiencing Him if we choose to not engage in the things that He calls us to.
Yeah. Cool.
That's a lot of ethic.
That is a lot of ethic. It's good. It's good. Ethic. It's tough to say fast. All right. Let's wrap her up with a little discussion about the new covenant. Because that was a good question that I think somebody brought up probably after the service when they were talking with you.
It's just one of those things that I was wrestling with. I know that's a question out there. Well, what about the new covenant that Jesus talks about? And, you know, is that, I don't see that in the diagram
Where does that fall? Where does that come into play?
Well, what they're talking about when they talk about new covenant, Jesus, the answer has to be Jesus, right?
Yeah, Jesus. There we go. Solved it.
So Jesus, when he's talking about communion or what comes out of the Seder meal, what comes out of the Lord's Supper, He said, this cup is poured out for you as the new covenant in my blood. So that's referenced in Luke 22:20, and the Apostle Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 11:25, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. Well, Jesus is actually using wedding language of that time, and may not be necessarily describing a new covenant as in starting a covenant like the Noahic covenant or the Sinai covenant, but maybe doing something very different. So these are... once a bride has been selected, the father and the future groom will go meet with the bride and her family. And once the families agree to the marriage, the father takes out a cup and pours some wine, and the groom-to-be takes the cup, offers it to his future bride, and will say, "This is the cup of a new covenant I make with you today. And I will not drink of this cup again until I drink it anew with you in my Father's house." Which sounds like some of the words that Jesus shares with his disciples.
Almost verbatim.
So at one point, Jesus says, "I go to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house are many rooms." Mm-hmm. And he says, "And I will come back to you." And maybe that's why... And there's other things that goes into this whole wedding covenant that we won't get into today. But at any rate, so instead of starting just a brand new covenant with just a few lines of text, maybe Jesus is just painting a picture.
A picture of the marriage, that. Aspect of it. But even if it is, because the marriage, it was a covenant, like they're forming a covenant,
right?
But there's also like there's an end. There's with every covenant there's a beginning and an end, right? Like it specifies when it ends, is my understanding. Now, whether or not that means that there isn't an end, and that's specified that, like, the Noahic covenant doesn't specify an end, so it doesn't ever end.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And as the graph showed, like, the Sinai covenant that the Jews are under didn't nullify the Abrahamic covenant.
Right.
And the Abrahamic covenant didn't nullify the Noahic. So the Jews are under all three of these. The Abrahamic covenant, Esau... is under the Noahic covenant also. Like there's nothing saying these can't stack.
Right.
And so there's nothing saying that if Christ is forming a new covenant here, this new covenant, there's nothing that says this new covenant does not stack within that diagram somewhere. Now, we could debate about where it stacks and have a conversation about that.
And maybe Jesus is so the covenant, the marriage covenant, I don't think it actually takes place until the bridegroom returns.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that's when it's really fulfilled or really.
Well, because isn't he saying in the covenant, even just within the verbiage there, that a new covenant I make with you, I won't drink of this cup again until I drink of it with you at my Father's house. So until we're married, like this is the covenant. Like until like I'm saying I'm going to go do this and you're going to wait for me until I have done this and we're going to go do this together.
Right.
Like this is what they're saying. They're laying out the terms there.
Right.
Which we should definitely have some well, when we go through Genesis. When we go through Genesis, we'll have to talk in depth about covenants.
That'll be a good question. Because
covenants are like, they show up all over the place. And I know for myself, I'm still learning about them. Like I did not get enough of that growing up in the church to understand what they actually mean and how they work. It would be like saying, it would be like using a copyright law book as my quote-unquote Bible, but not understanding how a legal form works, you know?
Yeah, and these are terms and phrases and processes that the disciples of the time, you know, at the Jerusalem Council, they fully understood what was being communicated here.
Mm-hmm.
And so when James says, well, we're gonna limit these guys to these three requirements under the Noahic covenant.
Yep.
You know, which, you know, like I'm with you. The 613 laws seems way easier than three broad categories. Grace, I think, is harder.
Mm-hmm.
Because am I doing enough? Am I doing it right? Am I, you know, like is the relationship working?
Yeah.
That's, you know, and that's, you know, I want to honor God in little things and big things. I pray about that all the time. Lord, I want to honor you in little things and big things. And, but it's just, but I think it's more representative of a relationship. Like 613, can you imagine if some gal came to you and said, hey, I want to get married, but here's my 613 rules for you. Does that feel like a relationship?
Not a good one.
No,
I think I'd have to, will have to regretfully turn down your proposition.
But if someone comes to you and they're like, hey, these are the three things that I really value. You're going to be figuring out, like, it's going to take a constant conversation for you to go, hey, how am I doing with this? You know, and
much more approachable, but a lot more gray area.
Yeah, a lot more
gray area.
It takes a lot more conversation. And maybe that's the point. Maybe the point is that we should be having a conversation with God every day about what our relationship with him looks like. And am I living this out well, Lord? And his spirit is in us and teaching us.
Yeah.
And as we engage with his word and we look at things that he says, you know, and we try to mine, you know, what his heart and intent is behind the things that he's saying in whatever study we're doing, maybe that is the case, what really God is after, a really flesh and blood relationship that has some give and take and some conversation, and it's on a journey and it's a little bit messy, maybe a lot messy. It doesn't look the same any 2 days.
No, and the Holy Spirit's going to tell us and convict us as to how we feel about those ethics and how we're walking that out.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't bring that up, but I think that's the role of the Holy Spirit. Like, I don't have to tell somebody how to live out that ethic. The Holy Spirit's going to tell them very much so if they are living out the ethic properly.
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
Cool.
I agree.
Well, it's been some good stuff. Glad to have you with us. If you got questions or you think something that we said was terribly wrong and you want to correct us, feel free to shoot us an email, info@missionridge.church, and we'd love to hear from you. If not, we're glad you joined us, and we'll talk to you next time.
Have a great week.
Peace.
You've been listening to Footnotes on the Mission Ridge podcast. For more information about Mission Ridge, please visit our website at missionridge.church. Thanks for tuning in. We hope the rest of your week is straight up #blessed, and that you'll join us again next week for more Footnotes.